He said we were the chosen ones, that the Earth was a dying ship, and we were the lucky few with a ticket home. I believed him so blindly that I never even questioned the poison, until the bodies started dropping. Now the faces I loved are silent beneath black shrouds, and I'm the only voice left to tell the story. The question isn't why they died. The question is how I survived. Welcome to the Skillful Art of Manipulation audiobook. If you haven't already, we invite you to follow us on your favorite podcast platform so you never miss a story. Today, we're honored to bring you The Celestial Cult Suicide, My Escape from the Comet's Grasp. Get ready to immerse yourself in a powerful, mind-blowing manipulation thriller that will leave you on the edge of your seat. Because here, our mission is to keep you coming back for more. So without further ado, let's dive into this thrilling narrative together. Chapter 1, The Chosen Ones. They called it the Night of Transition. I called it the night the air stopped moving. Even now, months later, I still wake with the copper taste of barbiturates burning the back of my throat. Still hear the faint hum of the sanctuary's generators, rattling through the walls like the heartbeat of a dying animal. Still feel the teacher's hand gripping mine in the dark, his voice a soft dagger sliding between my ribs. "You're ready, Eden," he whispered, the name he had given me when I surrendered my old one. "You've always been ready." I wasn't, but I nodded anyway. That's how it worked in the celestial sanctuary. You nodded. You smiled. You chanted the mantras until they filled your skull like wet cement. You wore the uniform, plain white shirts, soft cotton pants, the same brand of black Nikes ordered in bulk. You severed ties to your families, burned your photographs, erased your history like it had all been a fever dream. You became nothing, and in return, you were promised everything. The first time I saw the teacher, his real name erased from all record, like ours, he was standing under a canopy of stars in the desert, his silver hair catching the moonlight like a halo. His eyes were not warm. They were empty. But we mistook that emptiness for wisdom, for purity. He said he was not human anymore, not burdened by flesh. He said he was the vessel sent to carry us to the next vibrational plane. He said a ship was coming, that it would sail behind the Hale-Bopp comet like a pearl stitched to the edge of heaven. All we had to do was shed our earthly shells. I was 24 when I first heard those words. 24 and already hollowed out by a world that demanded too much and gave too little. The sanctuary felt like a reprieve, a sacred pause from the screaming hunger of existence. I never realized it was a mouth, waiting to swallow me whole. It started slowly. First the lessons, then the fasts, then the punishments, always wrapped in velvet words like adjustments and alignments. If you disobeyed, you didn't bleed. You just vanished. We learned not to ask where those people went. We learned to obey. To transcend, we must leave the corpse behind, the teacher told us one evening as we sat cross-legged in the grand hall, candles flickering low. Your family ties? Corpses. Your fear? A corpse. Your memories? Dead weight. Love, loyalty, doubt, all carcasses you must shed. I clutched the amulet around my neck, a thin silver pendant shaped like an eye inside a spiral, and told myself he was right. He had to be right, because if he wasn't, if this was all a lie, I didn't have anywhere else left to go. The first deaths were rehearsals. Dry runs, he called them. Drink the celestial elixir. A thick, bitter cocktail of crushed barbiturates, alcohol, and fruit juice, then lie still, breathing shallowly, simulating the release of the soul. We practiced letting go of life like it was a dance routine. We practiced dying. And every time I felt a little more numb, a little more ready. Graduation is an act of faith, the teacher said. Only the faithful will make it to the next world. Doubt is a noose. Belief is your wings. I wanted wings. God help me, I wanted them so badly. The night of transition, the teacher's voice trembled with something I had never heard before, urgency. Tonight, the comet sails its closest, he told us, a single tear rolling down his cheek. Tonight, the door opens. Tonight, we ascend. We gathered in the dormitories, our beds neatly made, our shoes perfectly aligned beneath us. We dressed in our uniforms. We swallowed the elixir. One by one, my brothers and sisters slipped away, their faces serene, as if they were just drifting into sleep. The teacher stroked my hair as I drank. His hand was cold. "You're almost home," he whispered. And then, nothing. A blank ocean. A screaming silence. A void so thick I thought I had already died. But somewhere deep inside me, something rebelled. Some stubborn, ugly scrap of life clawed its way up from the pit of my gut and refused. My stomach lurched. I stumbled from the bunk, retching, coughing, shivering as bile burned my throat. And when I opened my eyes, I was the only one left standing. They found me 2 days later, hiding in a closet, soaked in my own vomit and tears, clutching the silver amulet like a drowning woman clutches driftwood. I told them everything. But the truth? The real truth? Part of me never left the sanctuary. Part of me is still lying on that bunk, smiling into the darkness, waiting for a ship that never came. Chapter 2. Echoes in the Void. The days after the transition are a smear of light and noise and hands that aren't his. The investigators came with their clipboards and cameras, their polite horror veiled under procedural efficiency. They moved through the sanctuary like anthropologists dissecting a tomb, documenting every bunk, every body, every scrap of evidence, as if any of it could explain what we had done to ourselves. I remember blinking into the bright sun as they pulled me from the house, my skin burning, my mind reeling like a broken carousel. Someone wrapped a blanket around my shoulders. Someone else whispered into a radio. Survivor. She's in shock. God, she's just a kid. A kid. I almost laughed. There were no kids in the sanctuary. Only souls in waiting. Only flesh being prepped for slaughter. The state put me in a hospital at first. A sterile box painted in soft, soothing colors designed to pacify the insane. They called it a psychiatric hold. A 72-hour evaluation to make sure I wasn't a danger to myself or others. 3 days. 3 nights. 72 years. I stared at the walls until they rippled like water. I tried to remember the teacher's voice, but the harder I reached, the further it slipped, like smoke through my fingers. The world outside the sanctuary moved wrong. Too fast. Too loud. Too alive. I wasn't ready. The psychiatrist assigned to me was a woman named Dr. Helen Merrow. Mid-40s. Starched suits. Eyes that tried too hard to be kind. She never said the word cult directly, but it hung between us like a rotting carcass. You were conditioned, she said gently, flipping through her clipboard. It's normal to feel disoriented after prolonged exposure to structured belief systems. Conditioned. I hated the word. It made it sound like I had been tricked. Brainwashed. But hadn't I chosen this? Hadn't I wanted to believe? I said nothing. I sat in the plastic chair and picked at the scabbed-over cuts on my palms, still healing from where I had clutched the amulet too tightly. Do you remember why you didn't complete the transition? She asked, voice syrupy with concern. I flinched. Because I was weak. Because I was selfish. Because some ugly primal part of me, some vestigial animal, had clawed free and screamed N.O. into the void? I didn't answer. I didn't have to. The silence said it for me. They released me after 5 days, citing cooperation and no immediate risk of self-harm. Cooperation. Funny word for surrender. They handed me a paper bag of donated clothes, a bus ticket to nowhere, and a referral to a halfway house downtown. A place where lost souls went to pretend they weren't lost. As I stood on the sidewalk outside the hospital, the city roared around me. Car horns. Sirens. Shouting. Laughter. It all sounded like static. I tightened my grip on the amulet. It was the only thing I had left. I didn't belong here. Not in this world of flesh and glass and noise. I belong there, in the sanctuary. With them. With him. Even in death, he still whispered to me, curling into the hollow spaces he had carved in my mind. They don't understand, Eden. They never will. But you are chosen. You survived for a reason. I pressed my nails into my palms until the pain became a steady, grounding throb. Maybe he was right. Maybe I hadn't escaped. Maybe I had just graduated to a different kind of death. The halfway house was worse than the hospital. Peeling paint, flickering fluorescent lights, the sharp stench of bleach failing to cover the rot underneath. People slumped in broken chairs, their eyes hollowed out by different demons, drugs, alcohol, loneliness. I wasn't like them. At least, that's what I told myself at first. But by the third night, as I lay awake in my bunk, listening to the distant wail of sirens and the rattling of the heating pipes, I realized the truth. I was exactly like them. I was lost. I was contaminated. And worse, something inside me still ached for him. That's when the letters started. Small, handwritten notes slipped under my door at night. Notes that smelled faintly of incense and desert wind. We are watching over you, Eden. The journey is not over. Your ascension is still possible. I told myself it was a prank. A cruel joke by one of the other residents. But deep down, a part of me knew better. He was still reaching for me. From beyond death. From beyond reason. He had planted something inside me, a seed that refused to wither. And now it was growing. By the end of the week, the dreams returned. Vivid, smothering. Sweet. In them, the sanctuary was whole again. The grand hall was lit by 1,000 candles. The teacher stood at the altar, arms wide, his smile gentle, welcoming. "You left us behind," he whispered, voice cracking with sorrow. "But you can still come home." And every time, just before I could reach him, I woke up, alone, sweating, shaking, starving for something I couldn't name. The next morning, I found a package waiting outside my door. No return address. Inside, a pair of brand new black Nikes, and a vial of red liquid with a note. "Drink. Follow. Ascend." My hands trembled. My breath caught. Somewhere deep in my gut, the animal inside me, the same one that had fought for life that night, snarled awake. And this time it wasn't fear I felt. It was rage. Pure. Bright. Clean. Chapter 3. The Seeds of Return. The vial sat on my nightstand like a living thing. Small. Innocent looking. Terrible. I watched it for hours, half expecting it to move on its own, half expecting it to grow fangs and bite me in my sleep. "Drink. Follow. Ascend." The words on the note replayed in my mind like a cursed mantra. No signature. No instructions. Just the same quiet assumption they'd always demanded of us. Obedience without question. I didn't touch it. Not that night. Not the next morning either. But the knowledge of it bled into everything. The smell of my clothes, the taste of my food, the metallic ring in my ears. It owned me even untouched. 2 days later, I saw him. Or at least, I thought I did. I was walking back from the grocery store, arms heavy with cans of soup and boxed cereal, when I caught the silhouette out of the corner of my eye. Across the street, under the awning of an abandoned laundromat, a man in a plain white shirt, black pants, black Nikes. He stood so still he could have been a ghost. I froze. My heart stuttered. The rational part of me, the part Dr. Marrow would have praised, insisted it was a coincidence. A trick of the light. A random homeless guy dressed too much like my nightmares. But the animal part of me, the part that had kept me alive, knew better. It was one of them. That night, another note appeared under my door. "You are not alone, Eden. We are waiting. No more vial. No more packages." Just a whisper of breath against my skin that made it impossible to sleep. I lasted another week before breaking. Before giving in to the gnawing curiosity, the corrosive loneliness. Before taking the bus to the address scrawled at the bottom of the next note that arrived. It was an abandoned strip mall on the edge of the city, swallowed by ivy and disrepair. Unit 7C. The glass door was shattered, patched with duct tape and hope. No sign. No lights. Just a single candle flickering weakly in the farthest corner. I pushed the door open and stepped inside. He was waiting for me. Not the teacher. Another face I hadn't seen in over a year, Sarah. Sweet, trembling Sarah, who used to braid my hair by the campfires. Who used to weep during the purifications, whispering prayers for forgiveness even as the teacher's punishments bruised her skin. She looked older now. Sharper. Something had been carved out of her, some softness burned away. But her smile was the same. Wide. Hungry. "You made it," she said, voice trembling with what sounded like joy. I stood frozen in the doorway, bags of air caught in my lungs. "You survived too," I whispered. Sarah nodded. Her eyes gleamed wetly in the candlelight. "We all did." The room was filled with them. Not all 38. Not even half. Maybe a dozen. Each wearing the same uniform. Each wearing the same black sneakers. Each holding the same expression of reverent exhaustion. As if they'd been running a marathon toward salvation and hadn't yet crossed the finish line. Sarah stepped forward and took my hand, pressing something cold and familiar into my palm. An amulet, identical to the one I wore under my borrowed sweatshirt. "The teacher sent us back for you," she said. "Graduation isn't complete without you." For a moment, the floor beneath me tilted. The world spun. Not because I believed her. Not entirely. But because some traitorous part of me wanted to believe. Wanted to think that there was still purpose in my suffering. Still order in my chaos. Still family in this wilderness. Sarah pulled me deeper into the room. They formed a circle around me, their faces rapturous. One by one, they pressed their hands to my shoulders, my back, my arms, blessing me, branding me. "Welcome home," they whispered. "The comet returns soon. We must be ready. He speaks to us still." That night, I sat among them as they mapped out the next transition. A date, a time, a ritual. Only this time, it would not be quiet. It would not be private. The teacher's new vision demanded that the whole city see them ascend. Witnesses. Proof. They spoke of securing rooftops, of making themselves visible as they shed the corpse of the earth. They spoke of blood, and fire, and salvation. Sarah gripped my hand so tightly I could feel the pulse beating against my bones. "You're one of us, Eden," she breathed against my ear. "You always were. You're the missing star in our constellation." I nodded because that was what was expected. I smiled because that was what was safe. But inside, a war had begun. The animal in me, the wild, stubborn thing, was no longer just clawing for survival. It was planning. It was waiting. It was ready to fight. Because if they thought they could finish what they started, if they thought they could drag me back into the abyss, they had forgotten one thing. I had already died once, and I had no intention of dying again. Chapter 4. Rituals of Blood and Fire. The plan was simple. Simple the way a guillotine is simple. Sarah outlined it in low, reverent tones as we huddled inside the abandoned strip mall unit, the candle guttering between us. "March 22nd, she said. "The comet's zenith. The city must see us transcend. They must know the gateway is real. They called it the revelation. Not a quiet slipping away this time. No, this time it would be a pyre. A beacon of faith burning so brightly that even the blind would have to look. The target? The highest rooftop in the city. The Horizon Tower. 40 floors of steel and glass, clawing at the stars like a challenge. We would ascend from there, they said. In unison, a sea of bodies, stepping into the sky. They will envy us, Sarah whispered, her breath hot against my ear. They will mourn their chains while we soar. I nodded, swallowing down the acid rising in my throat. It was worse than before. So much worse. At least in the sanctuary, death had been private, a poisoned lullaby sung under heavy shrouds. Here it was an act of theater. A declaration. A massacre disguised as salvation. The preparations began immediately. There were new robes to sew, white linen, dyed with intricate symbols meant to mark the path. Supplies to gather, gasoline, flares, rope, chemicals. The elixir had been refined, Sarah said proudly, now concentrated enough to kill within minutes. I listened. I smiled. I helped. All the while, mapping every crack in their plans, every weakness in their zealotry. Because survival was no longer enough. This time I had to be the weapon. At night, I returned to the halfway house, a phantom among the ruined. No one noticed the black smudges on my hands, the smell of gasoline clinging to my clothes. No one asked why I stared out the window for hours, tracking the slow, stately arc of the comet across the sky. I wasn't sure if I was praying for deliverance or damnation. Maybe both. The letters kept coming. Folded scraps of paper slid under my door. In them, the teacher's voice lived on, smooth, magnetic, corrosive. You are the vessel now, Eden. Carry the flame. Lead them home. Become the door. Sometimes I thought about burning them. Sometimes I thought about answering. But most nights, I just sat in the dark, the amulet cold against my chest, and wondered if it was possible to kill a ghost. 3 nights before the planned revelation, Sarah summoned me alone to the strip mall. The others were busy with preparations, she said. She needed to speak with me privately. When I arrived, she was already waiting, kneeling before a battered altar cobbled together from scrap wood and broken mirrors. The candlelight threw monstrous shadows across her face. He speaks through me now, she said softly, reverently. He chose you. But he chose me too. I froze. The hairs on my arms prickled. We are the twin stars, Sarah continued, her voice trembling with emotion. 2 flames bound to ignite the sky. You will lead them, Eden. I will guide you. She pressed her forehead to the floor. Prostrated herself like a penitent before a god. I stared down at her, my heart pounding so hard it rattled my teeth. This wasn't about belief anymore. This wasn't about salvation. It was about power. And Sarah, sweet, broken Sarah, had drunk the poison so deeply she had become part of it. I left that night with a new plan burning in my veins. I would not run. I would not hide. I would climb that rooftop with them. I would sing their hymns. I would drink their poison. And at the final moment, when the stars were watching, when the city held its breath, I would tear it all down. The day of the revelation dawned cold and silver. A brittle wind cut through the city, snapping flags and tugging at coats. I wore the robe they had made me, the white linen heavy against my skin, the red symbols blooming across the fabric like open wounds. At the base of Horizon Tower, we gathered. 12 of us. A living prayer. Sarah's face was luminous with joy. The others swayed gently, already half drunk on the promises whispered into their ears. No one questioned the duffel bags we carried. No one stopped us as we slipped through the service entrance and into the heart of the tower. The elevator creaked and shuddered under our weight as we rose. floor by floor, heartbeat by heartbeat, closer to heaven, closer to hell. When the doors slid open, the rooftop greeted us like an altar. The city sprawled beneath us, cold, glittering, indifferent. Above, the comet burned a scar across the twilight. Sarah knelt and began to chant, her voice threading through the cold air like smoke. The others followed, their hands raised, their mouths forming the ancient, blasphemous syllables the teacher had taught us. Vibrational unity. Ascension through fire. Sacrifice of the vessel. I moved among them, handing out the vials, the flares, the matches. Smiling. Nodding. Lying. Because tucked inside my robe, pressed against my racing heart, was a second lighter and a small, dense bundle of explosives stolen from the construction site next to the halfway house. If they wanted a revelation, if they wanted the sky to weep for them, I would give it to them, but not the way they expected. As Sarah raised the first flare high, her face ecstatic, the moment came. I struck the lighter, lit the fuse, and smiled. Chapter 5, Ashes of Salvation. The lighter's flame hissed to life in my palm, small and defiant against the howling rooftop wind. The fuse sputtered, angry, alive, sparking a trail of light across the cracked concrete beneath my feet. Sarah didn't notice at first. None of them did. They were too busy preparing to die. Their hands lifted in supplication, their mouths open in silent rapture. The flare in Sarah's grip blazed blood red against the darkening sky, casting her face into a mask of religious ecstasy. "Tonight we fly," she cried, and a ragged cheer went up from the others. I tightened my grip around the lighter, tightened my mind around the decision. No going back. No second chances. Only fire. Only the truth. The fuse kissed the bundled explosives hidden beneath the service panel at the rooftop's edge. A low whump sounded beneath our feet, almost delicate. A tremor. A warning. Sarah's head snapped toward me, the flare trembling in her hand. For the first time, doubt flickered in her eyes. "Eden," she whispered. I didn't answer. I just smiled, wide, bloody, triumphant. Because in that moment, I wasn't Eden the follower. I wasn't Eden the lost lamb. I was Eden the betrayer. Eden the executioner. Eden the last fucking survivor. The rooftop erupted in chaos. The explosives weren't enough to collapse the tower, but they were enough to tear the ritual apart. Gasoline canisters overturned, spilling rivers of fire across the concrete. Flames licked up the hems of white robes. Flares clattered to the ground, igniting in bursts of searing color. The faithful screamed. Some ran. Some knelt stubbornly, refusing to believe their promised ascension had turned into a living hell. Sarah dropped her flare, her face frozen between fury and heartbreak. "You lied," she shrieked, voice cracking under the betrayal. "You were chosen." I laughed, a raw, broken sound ripped straight from my ribs. "I chose myself," I roared over the rising inferno. "I chose life." Someone tackled me from behind. Fingers scrabbled at my face, my throat. I rolled, kicked, shoved. The rooftop became a battlefield, white robes streaked with soot, faces twisted by smoke and fear. Some still tried to light the elixirs, desperate to complete the ritual even as their sanctuary burned around them. Others turned on each other, their unity crumbling into primal survival. The fire ate greedily, devouring robes, banners, gasoline trails. The comet overhead blazed brighter, indifferent. Sarah found me again at the edge of the rooftop, blood smeared across her mouth, a length of rope clutched in her hand like a weapon. "If we fall together," she panted, "we can still ascend." Her grip on the rope was trembling but relentless. She lunged. I sidestepped, grabbing her wrist midair. For a moment, we teetered on the edge, the world sprawling dizzyingly below. Sarah's eyes were wild with grief, with fanatic love. "Don't you see?" she sobbed. "This is mercy." I looked into her face, searching for the girl who used to braid my hair under the desert stars. But she was gone, burned away. Only ash remained. "I'm sorry," I whispered. And then I let her fall. She didn't scream. Not really. Just a gasp, torn away by the wind as she disappeared into the city's glittering throat. I stumbled back, coughing, sobbing, the smoke clawing at my lungs. The rooftop was collapsing in patches now, the fire finding every weakness. Some of the faithful still chanted, even as the flames consumed them. Others lay motionless, already surrendered. I didn't wait to see who lived or died. I ran. Down the stairwell, past the flickering emergency lights, past the alarms howling like dying animals. I ran until the world blurred into noise and heat and darkness. I ran until my knees buckled and my palms scraped raw against concrete. I ran until the city swallowed me whole. Later, they would call it an accident, a chemical explosion during unauthorized construction. No survivors among the cultists. No clear answers. Just another horror story in a world addicted to them. They wouldn't know about the letters, the rituals, the second coming that almost was. They wouldn't know about Sarah. About me. I disappeared after that. Changed my name. Dyed my hair. Moved from city to city like a shadow, trying not to cast itself. I still wake some nights drenched in sweat, the smell of gasoline thick in my nostrils. I still see Sarah's face in my dreams. Still hear the teacher's voice, promising me stars. Promising me peace. Promising me home. But now, when I hear him, I don't listen. I remember the fire. I remember the fall. I remember choosing life, even when death sang sweeter. And for once, the void doesn't pull at me the way it used to. For once, the abyss stares back and finds me staring harder. Because I'm not the lost girl from the sanctuary anymore. I am the ashes. I am the ruin. And if they ever come again, if another teacher rises, another comet sails, another soft voice whispers salvation into the ears of the desperate, I'll be waiting, flame in hand. Chapter 6. Ghosts in the Smoke. Freedom is an ugly thing when you're not ready for it. They say survival is the beginning of healing. That once you claw your way back into the light, the rest will follow. They never tell you about the smell of burnt flesh that won't leave your clothes. The phantom touches that make you flinch from strangers. The way a simple bus ride, a flickering street lamp, the wrong brand of sneakers, can unspool you into nothingness. I drifted for months. City to city. State to state. Sleeping in bus stations, cheap motels, charity shelters where the volunteers smiled too tightly and kept their purses close. I changed my name so often it became a game. Seeing how long I could wear a new skin before it cracked. Sometimes I was Emma. Sometimes June. Sometimes just a letter scribbled on a form. None of them fit. None of them were real. I wasn't real. But the ghosts were. Everywhere I went, they followed. Lurking in reflections. Curling at the edge of my hearing. Tugging at the frayed edges of my mind. Sarah's wide, trusting eyes as she fell. The teacher's serene smile as he offered poison disguised as love. The weight of the amulet still cold against my chest, hidden beneath layers of new clothes, new identities. I told myself I should throw it away. Bury it. Burn it. Forget it. But I didn't. I couldn't. Because deep down it wasn't a trophy. It was a warning. One night, in a grimy motel room in Kansas City, I woke to the sound of someone knocking at the door. Three sharp raps. Then silence. The clock on the nightstand read 3:33 a.m. Of course it did. I stayed frozen under the thin blanket, every nerve screaming. Another knock. Softer this time. More patient. I crept toward the door, every footstep a gunshot in the silent room. Pressed my eye to the peephole. Nothing. Just the oily yellow light of the parking lot. Just the empty walkway. I waited, heart a drum in my throat. After what felt like hours, I slid the deadbolt free and cracked the door open. A package sat on the doormat. No return address. No markings. Just a plain white box wrapped in twine. I should have slammed the door. Should have locked every bolt, pushed furniture against it, prayed to whatever god still listened. Instead, I reached down and picked it up. It was cold. Heavy. Inside. A pair of black Nikes. Brand new. Tags still attached. And a note. The journey isn't over. No signature. But I didn't need one. I dropped the box like it burned. Staggered back into the room, heart hammering, hands slick with sweat. They were dead. I saw them die. I made them die. I burned it all to ash. There was no one left to send this. Except maybe, there was. The next morning, I checked out without showering. Without eating. Took a bus to nowhere in particular. Slept with my back against the window, one eye open. Watched every face too long, too closely. Because if Sarah survived, if even one of them survived, if someone had clawed their way out of that fire the way I had, then the war wasn't over. The teacher's voice wasn't a ghost. It was a seed. Still growing. Still waiting. Still reaching. Over the next weeks, the signs multiplied. A flyer posted on a cracked telephone pole. Ascend beyond. A spray-painted eye spiraled on the wall of a train station bathroom. A man in a crowded street corner, handing out leaflets promising release from the corpse of Earth. Each time my pulse flared. Each time, the air grew thinner around me. They were rebuilding. Somewhere in the cracks of this broken country, the sanctuary was rising again. And they wanted me back. Not to save me. No, that was never the point. They wanted me because I was proof. Proof that death wasn't the end. proof that survival was just another form of obedience. Proof that even fire couldn't kill Faith. The final confirmation came one night in Detroit, in a battered coffee shop where the lights buzzed and the coffee tasted like rust. A man sat across from me uninvited. Tall. Gaunt. Pale hands folded neatly around a chipped mug. He smiled. Slow. Patient. "We've missed you, Eden," he said. No name. No threat. Just a quiet certainty that he didn't need either. The same certainty the teacher once wore like a second skin. I stood so fast the chair toppled. Ran without paying. Without thinking. Out into the freezing night, heart hammering against the inside of my ribs like a caged bird. They knew. They had always known. There would be no outrunning it. No hiding. The comet was gone, burned out of the sky. But the cult, the rot it planted, was alive. And it was growing. Worse. Smarter. Hungrier. The sanctuary had not died with the fire. It had simply gone underground, waiting for the next celestial sign, the next broken soul to promise a way home. Waiting for me. Chapter 7. The Last Light. I used to think survival was a finish line. A brutal, blood-soaked one, but final. Now I understand survival is a relay race you never finish. You just pass the baton between different versions of yourself, hoping the next one is strong enough to keep running. I was tired of running. Tired of looking over my shoulder. Tired of waking up choking on smoke I couldn't see. Tired of waiting for the sanctuary's hand to close around my throat again. So I made a choice. The last choice. Not to run. Not to hide. But to burn it all down, properly this time. No unfinished flames. No survivors whispering in the cracks. If the sanctuary wanted a reckoning, I would bring it to them. I started with the fragments. I tracked the signs, the flyers, the symbols, the whispers in underground forums, and pieced them together into a map. A web of meeting places. Recruitment hubs. Safe houses painted in invisible ink. It was easier than I thought. Desperation makes people sloppy. Fanaticism makes them arrogant. They thought they were untouchable because they believed they were already halfway ascended. They forgot what a fallen angel can do. I found the new sanctuary in an abandoned church outside of Tulsa. The old stone building squatted on the edge of the woods like a wounded beast, its windows broken and its bell silent. Inside, candles flickered against graffiti-stained walls. A new congregation knelt before a crude altar, nothing more than a table draped in white, stained red with offerings. And at the front, a figure, draped in white, voice low and mesmerizing, preaching not salvation but abandonment. "Leave your corpse behind," he intoned. "Your mind, your fears, your pain, shed it all." I stepped through the doorway, my boots crunching over shattered glass. Every head turned toward me, eyes wide, mouth slack. Recognition flickered through them like wildfire. Some whispered my name, Eden, like a prayer, like a curse. The leader paused. His face was new, young, handsome in a way the teacher never was. But the voice was the same, the voice of death dressed up in hope. He smiled. "Welcome home, Eden," he said. I smiled back, pulled the bag from my shoulder, tossed it at his feet. He blinked down at it, confused, just as I pulled the detonator from my pocket. "Home is dead," I said, and pressed the button. The explosion wasn't cinematic. It was brutal. Sudden. The blast tore the altar apart, sending stone and fire and blood into the air. Screams erupted. High, ragged animal. Smoke churned through the nave, swallowing banners and bodies alike. I moved through it like a ghost. Unstoppable. Unreachable. The leader stumbled toward me, blood soaking his robe, eyes wide with disbelief. "Why?" he gasped, reaching for me. I stepped back, watching him crumble. "Because you won't take anyone else," I said. And then he was gone. I left the church burning behind me. Didn't look back. Didn't need to. Some fires you don't watch. You just let them consume. The news called it an accident. A gas leak. No one looked deeper. No one cared enough to see the fingerprints of Faith twisted into madness. But I knew. And somewhere maybe they did too. The ones who weren't there that night. The ones still hiding, still waiting. I had sent them a message. "I survived you. And I am not afraid anymore. Now I move differently. Not as prey. Not as a fugitive. But as a warning. When I see the signs, the spirals, the black Nikes, the soft smiles promising release, I don't run. I get close. I listen. And when the time is right, I light the match, because survival isn't enough. Not for people like me. We don't survive. We hunt. We burn. We end it.